With great relief, Anya sat on the foot of her bed to take off her shoes. Their hotel room was spacious, clean, and much like any fine hotel room anywhere. Not that Anya had spent much time in hotel rooms as nice as this one. She had been actively uncomfortable with the notion of staying in a five-star establishment. Also, it was in the Zona Sul, the South Zone, on the other end of town from their objective of the next morning, as well as from the international airport where they'd landed and from which they'd depart, if they survived the trip. But Aiden had insisted. After what they'd been through, including the series of adequate but shabby rooms in Mediterranean motels and down-at-the-heels pensiones they'd shared the past few nights, he said they deserved a luxury break. Besides, he paid. He stood in his sock feet, gazing out the floor-to-ceiling window at Peppino Beach. Despite their elevation on the 9th floor, there wasn't much to see beyond the bright lights of the parking lot, except the tiny lights of some vessels well out on the water.
You can go out on the balcony.
If I open the door, it will be like being hit in the face with a wet woolen blanket. I think I'll avail myself of the wonders of modern air conditioning a while longer.
He turned and dropped into a recliner chair. Anya lay back on the bed with her own feet, now bare, resting on the carpet. She rolled her eyes to look at him. With only the lamp between the beds lit, it wasn't too bright in the room. Despite that, she thought he looked troubled, in his posture, if not expression.
Something's bothering you.
No.
They had stopped off in the bar downstairs to sample the national drink, caipirinha, made with sugarcane liquor, called cachaça, mixed with lemon and ice. Unlike many of their colleagues, neither was much of a drinker. Anya felt more than a little elevated.
Not a bit of it.
Rather than keep her from feeling anxious about her companion's mood, her slight buzz seemed to sharpen her anxiety. She wondered at the phenomenon without knowing what to do about it.
Come on. Please don't fence me out.
For some reason, I've been thinking about those Greek fishermen who braced us on the beach in Corfu.
What about them?
You didn't kill them.
Would you prefer I had?
No. I was wondering, why didn't you? You killed some of those men attacking me in Jerusalem.
They attacked me too, if you'll recall.
Sure, but so did the Greeks. What makes the difference? Who lives, who dies? It couldn't have made any difference that those men in Jerusalem were Jewish, could it?
You can't seriously believe that about me. And don't you think charges of anti-Semitism are being tossed about just a bit too freely these days? That kind of thing is unworthy of you.
She loomed over him.
Sorry, love. I don't know what made me say that, but it's a question that's been bothering me, that's all. Some men die, some live. And you have the power to make that decision.
Anya turned away. His use of the word love had struck her like the jab of a baton in the belly. She knew it was casual, an English turn of phrase. No doubt it signified little more than he was slightly inebriated, enough to have disregarded the political correctness of using a word that might be deemed sexist. But still...
Nothing gets a girl worked up like reminding her how isolated she really is.
She remembered Sipora's prediction or prophecy on taking leave of her in Jerusalem. The fact that the wise woman's other prognostication, that their paths would never cross again, hadn't panned out, was small consolation right now. Aiden was standing behind her.
Look, I know you do the best you can. I can't really judge you, because I've no way of sharing your burden. And you saved my life twice, if memory serves. I'm a bloody ingrate and a twice bloody fool. Please, just forget I spoke.
No, it's true. Not that it made any difference to me that those men in Jerusalem were Jewish, even if they were. I have no way of knowing that. Not really. But what is true is that I used the sword without much hesitation, and I couldn't make myself use it on those men on the beach. I couldn't have summoned the sword. My will was clouded. I didn't feel right.
She felt him standing behind her. His breath stirred the hair at the back of her neck, where she'd tied it up to keep cooler in the muggy heat.
I understand. I think I do. It was the intent.
Their intent was to kill us, those fishermen. I mean, I thought that their motives were purer. They were doing it to avenge their dead friends and also to protect their living one. But what if the men who attacked you in the old city thought they were doing the right thing too? They must have.
Isn't that the burden you have to bear? Trying as best you can, with imperfect knowledge and poor old human fallibility, to judge what's good and what isn't? We all have to make those decisions, I suppose. But with you, there tend to be harsher consequences.
She raised her head and looked out into the dark.
You don't think I'm delusional? Some kind of psychopath? A serial killer who imagines she has a mission to cleanse the world of evil?
The sword is a pretty convincing delusion, Anya. And I haven't seen you execute anybody in cold blood, only defend yourself. And me. I don't pretend to understand all the moral ramifications of this mission of yours. Which I guess, now that I step back, makes me understand the pressure you're under even more.
I wish I understood better. Sometimes I don't think I'm suited to this new life. It just sounds impossibly grandiose even to say. I don't know if anybody's up to a role like that. How can I possibly live up to it?
Her eyes stung, filled with warm tears.
Self-pity? Too much alcohol?
She felt his hand on her shoulder, firm, gentle.
Perhaps that's why you were chosen. Because you have the strength and integrity to ask questions.
She turned. Her breath seemed to catch in her chest. His eyes were fixed on hers. They seemed to glow. She grabbed him by the head almost roughly. She pressed her mouth to his. A frozen moment in which her mind wheeled with fear and embarrassment.
I've pushed it too far. I'll scare him off.
Then his hand was behind her neck. A quick, smooth gesture, and he had plucked the long pin she used to tie up her hair. It fell in a cascade to her shoulders. Their tongues twined, their faces pressed together so hard, her lips were numbed by unaccustomed pressure. In a sudden adolescent frenzy, their hands were in motion, undressing themselves, undressing each other. They had finished gracelessly hopping free of their undergarments and landed on the bed together.
Admiral Cochrane's Forge.
Aiden peered through lush green underbrush.
The place itself is a great deal less prepossessing than the name, I have to say.
They had parked their rented Toyota on the side of a track off the main road, crossing their fingers it wouldn't get bogged down on uncertain ground. Then they had hiked a quarter mile or so through the woods to reach the outskirts of the foundry. Though she was in superb shape and used to hiking cross-country, the humid heat and swarming bugs had Anya wondering if they were being paranoid in their approach. The forge, after all, had a marked blacktop road leading to a lot graded out of the surrounding forest. But even though the occasional dark look and scowl from her companion told her his thoughts ran down the same track, she was just as glad they had taken a roundabout route. After what they'd experienced the past week or so, too paranoid might prove barely paranoid enough. The smelter was a sprawling rectangular building and seemed to be mostly metal post and rusty sheet metal in construction. Even in the bright daylight, the fiery glare was visibly spilling out the front. They could feel heat on their faces 100 yards off.
Charming place to work.
I'm sure their safety standards are as up-to-date as their equipment, too. Still, I guess the heat is easier to endure than starvation, even if you throw in the risk from the occasional splash of molten metal.
A few cars stood parked by the building's rust-streaked flank, several foreign sedans and a battered white Range Rover. They probably belonged to the technical staff and foreman. Anya guessed the workers probably walked.
I don't see any sign of trouble. Maybe we did hike all this way for nothing.
He took off his bush hat and wiped sweat from his face with a handkerchief. He wore a light blue cotton short-sleeved shirt, now with big half-moons of sweat beneath the arms, and his customary blue jeans. Anya wore a cheap Panama hat and her usual field garb of man's white shirt and khaki cargo pants. She had the sleeves rolled down for the same reasons she avoided shorts in the heat, to discourage the plentiful and voracious Brazilian insect life.
I wonder what it's like in the bloody Amazon with all these bloody bugs they have down here.
Worse in the lower Amazon, I imagine. The upper Amazon, where I've been, was not quite so bad. Close call, though.
She studied him. She wasn't sure how she felt about the previous night. At breakfast in one of the hotel's restaurants, Aiden had been his usual self, not so much bubbling over with humor as voluble about his interests and passions with a dry backing of humor. She thought there had been an extra flush to his normally pink cheeks, but perhaps she'd imagined that. She felt as if her cheeks were a bit rosier, though. She had, however, studiously avoided letting herself think about what had happened between them, or what it might portend.
What do you think?
One thing you could say for him was that he seemed to have little trouble deferring to a woman in a potentially dangerous situation.
I say we go. Race you?
He touched two fingers to her arm.
Won't it be less obtrusive if we just walk?
Good point.
They strolled out of the brush as casually as if they came this way every day about this time. Anya and Aiden walked at a matter-of-fact pace toward the structure, feeling the heat on their faces grow with every step.
Think they have surveillance cameras?
The place looks as if they're in there listening to an old radio with vacuum tubes. But we can't take anything for granted. Not with surveillance equipment so cheap these days. Still, does it really make a difference?
I suppose not.
They approached the open front of the building. Ignoring a door covered in flaking green paint, they walked to the big opening. Anya leaned forward and peered around the wall. Furnace heat and the stench of hot metal hit her in the face. Even after the heat of the tropical sunlight, it was almost staggering.
Inferno.
Through eyes watering from heat and the chemical smell, she got an impression of a vast, dark face shot through the glow of fires. Great tangled machines loomed and catwalks strung back and forth like a steel spiderweb above. Vast black cauldrons emerged from an enormous yellow furnace mouth, drooling liquid metal. Streams of living flame like lava fell into molds, sparks showering and skittering on the floor as they reddened, faded, winked out. Black men, bare to the waist, moved through the hellish tumult with almost desperate purpose, carrying long poles with hooks and outsized tongs. Wiry torsos ran with sweat. The glare reflected and skittered over their safety helmets. The display might have stirred a favorable response inside Anya, who liked looking at well-muscled, scantily clad men as much as the next woman. Instead, she found it somewhat frightening and sad.
How can anybody work in that?
Necessity. I guess if archaeology teaches us anything, it's just how much humans can learn to tolerate if they have to.
Poor bastards.
Amen. Let's get in there.
The brightness of the furnace seemed to make the shadows darker, defeating the lights hanging from the ceiling high overhead. There were ample hiding places, even had anyone been looking around, but no one was. They moved toward the back, keeping close to the left wall. Exhausted crucibles, suspended from a track overhead, were conveyed out another wide opening of the far wall into daylight. Before them, an enclosed space intruded onto the main floor, its lone story far below the cavernous ceiling. It appeared to contain an office with windows in its flank showing desks and computer monitors, with men in shirt sleeves sitting at them. It struck Anya as being way too close for either comfort or safety to where the fuming cauldrons tipped their cargo into the waiting molds. 7 or 8 yards beyond the far side of the structure yawned the mouth of the furnace itself. Anya stopped, heart and throat. She ducked behind some kind of great, rounded, gray-painted metal casing. Aiden sidled up next to her.
What is it?
She pointed. A dozen or more men in dark suits stood confronting office workers in shirt sleeves in front of the office area. All of them wore large silver medallions on chains around their necks. One man wore a suit all of white and cream rather than dark fabric. He loomed above the others and appeared thin as a flagpole.
It's Highsmith!
My God, those men have guns!
It was true. Sir Martin's followers, at least a dozen in view, held a variety of firearms, some handguns, some long arms, machine pistols, shotguns, assault rifles. Looking around, Anya saw more armed men moving around the work floor. The foundry workers themselves paid scant attention to them. They were probably not unaccustomed to seeing heavily armed men. Houses of the wealthy, and even exclusive apartment complexes, routinely sported guards carrying submachine guns in Brazil. Or maybe in comparison to the tons of 2,000-degree liquid metal swaying over their heads and pouring out in great glaring streams like lava, the firearms just didn't seem dangerous.
What now?
We get in closer!
His expression told her what he thought of that idea. With a flip of his hand, he gave her a "you first" gesture. The White Tree Lodge members seemed preoccupied with keeping an eye on the foundry employees. They weren't looking for people sneaking through the heavy metal machinery on the floor. Anya and Aiden got within 30 feet of the two groups in front of the door to the office.
Now, I do not know what the foreign gentlemen are talking about.
Dennis!
Without warning, a short cultist with a shock of unruly dark hair shot the young Brazilian to the manager's left through the knee. Aiden tensed as if to lunge. Anya put a restraining hand on his arm.
We can't just watch.
What do you suggest we do? They've got us outmanned and outgunned.
You've got that magical sword.
I can't knock bullets out of the air.
She looked around nervously. Though it seemed unlikely anyone could have heard their soft-voiced but intense conversation, the odds against them were too high for her to take anything for granted.
But surely you don't mean to do nothing.
We'll do something, but we need to wait for an opportunity.
Anya grabbed him by the arm and put her finger to his lips. His eyes widened in outrage.
Wait. The equation just changed.
She tipped her head toward the large front door. After a scowling moment, his eyes followed her lead. More men were striding in out of the brightness of the morning. They were thick-necked men, white, obviously foreigners, though their garb was mostly rough. Their posture suggested arrogance. They also openly carried guns. Green braided leather thongs circled their thick necks. Among them walked Mark Peter Stern in a tropical weight tan suit, a yarmulke on his gleaming gold hair. A White Tree cultist who had worked his way toward the large opening raised a shotgun. One of Stern's followers fired a burst from his hip with an Uzi.
Take them!
The White Tree cultists opened fire. Two of Stern's men fell. Another backed away, firing an Uzi machine pistol from the hip. Anya ducked as random bullets cracked overhead and whined in ricochets off the machinery around them. She wished she had ducked when the shooting first began and not seen what she had just seen. Aiden hunkered beside her, looking sick.
What now?
We can't just hide. They'll find us if we do.
He nodded, swallowing spasmodically as if trying to control his emotions. Her stomach was churning. She turned away. She knew she could not afford to be incapacitated by a fit of nausea. Without any dignified course coming to mind, Anya crawled on all fours toward the office where it protruded onto the shop floor. Coming within 10 feet of it, with what she thought might be a lathe shielding her from the interior of the building where most of the action was, and a big red toolbox on wheels between her and the office, she cautiously reared up and peered over. Throughout the smelter, men fought furiously. Some fired at each other from behind cover. No one was having much success. Much of the equipment, and even general clutter inside the vast building, was steel or iron, dense and massive enough to stop bullets. Other men wailed at each other with wrenches, metal rods, bits of scrap, as far as Anya could tell. Some simply pummeled each other, wrestled, shrieked, gouged eyes, and tore at throats with their teeth.
My God! I've never seen anything like this!
They both ducked as a burst of gunfire raked across the top of the lathe table, bullets howling like lost souls as they tumbled to rip irregular holes in the thin sheet metal wall above their heads.
The rage and passion, they're increasing it, trying to use it to manipulate them. But at the same time, all that emotion is working on them, too. They're getting themselves into a frenzy, losing control. Listen, you just stay here until everybody's distracted. Then try to find the jar.
What are you going to do?
Something showy and stupid enough to make sure everybody's looking at me.
Wait!
She didn't. She couldn't. Bent low, she scrambled several feet deeper into the foundry and peered over a steel table with a shelf beneath it piled thick with rusty junk. The shooting suddenly stopped. As Anya had hoped, many of the gunmen had exhausted their magazines and needed to reload. She hoped to make use of the lull in the gunfight.
Listen to me. You've got to stop this. Can't you see you're being used?
Mark Peter Stern stepped into view from a side niche near the open maw of the furnace.
My, you're a woman of unusual talents for a TV archaeologist.
I'm a real archaeologist.
You are the inconvenient young woman who came to my manor in the guise of a researcher.
Anya raised her head. Sir Martin Highsmith stood up on the catwalk, his own white suit gleaming as if spotlit in the glare of the halted crucible, whose contents had only cooled to yellow from near white. Its sides glowed red,
Enlighten us, then. Used by whom?
Demons.
That's a good one. Demons. Don't be ridiculous.
You think when you get the jar, you'll control them. But you're already in mortal peril of your souls. Aiden, I hope this is providing enough of a diversion.
Foolish woman! Do you really think we have no means of protecting ourselves?
Listen to me, please. We can work together. We can work things out like reasonable people.
You're just like all of us. You just want the jar for yourself.
The sword was in her hand.
You are dead, interloper. You cannot reach me with that sword of yours.
He was right. Anya willed the sword away. Then she yanked a Glock from a dead man's fingers, rolled onto her back, aimed for Sir Martin's chest, and squeezed the trigger. Sir Martin fell backward over the rail. From the front of the foundry, a sound erupted as if a decade's worth of hailstones were being unloaded on the corrugated metal roof at once. Out on the floor, men began to spin and fall with little red sprays jetting from everywhere. Her head snapped toward the entrance. A line of men marched shoulder to shoulder into the smelter, dark forms silhouetted against the tropical morning sun. Most were firing machine pistol-sized Kalashnikovs from the hip. They stepped aside, only to walk around machines in their path. Interspersed with them was a quartet of what Anya recognized with a shock as Orthodox priests in flowing vestments with basket-shaped hats on their heads and magnificent beards. In the middle of the line, a smaller man was dwarfed by the burly gunners. He walked with a bandy-legged swagger of total self-assurance. He looked oddly familiar. The man raised his hand. Flame bloomed from it, right toward Anya's face. She set her jaw and waited for the fatal impact. Instead, the bullet cracked past her head. She turned back to see a Malkuth cultist toppling backward. The invaders mowed down Malkuth and White Tree men with a fine lack of discrimination.
The Babylonians come again! But I will not be taken into captivity!
All the rest of the cultists lay on the floor, dead or dying. The diminutive man with the Glock held up a hand. He halted near Anya. His men stopped at the same time, lowering their weapons but staying alert. He was a very trim man, with receding hair cropped close to a narrow skull and piercing eyes. He wore a dark suit over a dark pullover of some sort, very well tailored to his athletic form. It took Anya a moment to regain some composure. She looked at the man with surprise. He was the leader of the group of mafia goons who had surprised her and Aiden in Amsterdam. Mark Peter Stern's tall form suddenly appeared, silhouetted against the furnace's blinding yellow maw. Blue flames jetted in like fangs from the periphery.
I am protected by the power of the Lord of Hosts. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil.
He turned and walked into the furnace.
For thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me.
His outline blurred as his suit took flame. He stopped. He made it three steps, then fell to his knees. A moment later, and he slumped into a shapeless mound, like a wax figurine melting. An especially tall mafia man with a head like a shaved bear's and hair in his ears said something to his small and dapper leader. The smaller man shrugged.
What's going on?
We are restoring peace. Did you never hear, blessed are the peacemakers?
Why haven't you killed me yet?
I forget my manners. Please forgive me. I am Valeri Korolin, formerly captain of Special Designation Soldiers in Armed Forces of USSR. Now I work in private sector. You are Ms. Anya Creed.
You haven't answered my question.
You are a very courageous young woman, if perhaps not so prudent. But we knew that. We haven't killed you because you haven't gotten in our way.
You tried hard enough before.
Those were mistakes. In Amsterdam, my men thought you might be the killers of that poor old lady shopkeeper. In Jaffa, our attempt was to incinerate Dr. Stern.
who seems to have escaped our efforts only to carry out our intentions by himself.
He shook his head, still marveling at Stern's walking voluntarily into the blazing furnace.
And now, since it is obvious you do not have the jar, if you'll excuse us...
She doesn't have it, but I do.
Everyone looked up. Aiden Pascoe stood on the catwalk. Above his head, he brandished a gleaming metal jar in the shape of a globe with a funnel thrust into it and two oddly slender scrolled handles. Anya drew in a sharp breath. She could feel it. It was Solomon's jar. With a guilty start, she realized Corolan was looking at her closely. He nodded sharply. Then he turned to look up at Pascoe.
Mr. Pascoe, please throw down to us the jar.
I won't. And if you shoot me or try to take it from me by force, I'll throw it in the melt. Then no one will get it.
What do you want it for, Mr. Pascoe?
Tell him, Anya.
Anya was concerned. He seemed to be standing in the midst of a dark whirlwind. She wasn't sure if she was literally seeing it with her eyes or some other sense, but she knew what she was seeing. Aiden Pascoe was struggling with temptation.
Why don't you tell them, Aiden?
The power to make the world a better place. That's what I've dreamed of since I was a child. What do you want it for?
Very simple. A wealthy and well-connected collector in St. Petersburg offers a substantial sum of money for authenticated jar of King Solomon. He desires this object solely for its value as artifact of the ancient world. He is an atheist. He is merely obsessed with history.
He wants to display it?
He wants to be able to admire it and to show it off to favored guests, or so I presume. He is prepared to preserve it using the best modern techniques.
What about you? What do you think about the jar?
I think I will receive a munificent reward for success, rather than getting shot in the back of the neck for failure, maybe.
But the demons...
I myself am also atheist. I do not believe in demons.
Why did you bring the priests?
I do not believe in demons, but I do believe in hedging my bets, Miss Creed. After all, if there are no demons, I have only subjected myself to smelling some incense and listening to some mumbo-jumbo. And if there are demons...
Selfishness! Pure selfishness! The root of all evil!
How do you plan to make the world better, Aiden?
Whose side are you on?
You know which side, Aiden. Ask yourself that question. Please.
He looked at her, suspicion narrowing his blue eyes.
Very well. I will put an end to human suffering, to evil, if you will, by confining the demons that were released through the selfish greed of the treasure hunters who breached the seal.
Aiden, are you sure that would even work?
His eyes narrowed in suspicion.
What do you mean? Of course it would.
Do you think all the evil went out of the world when Solomon sealed the demons in that jar, Aiden? The demons may personify human evil, abet it, but they don't cause it. Humans do that themselves, don't they?
Aiden was frowning, but he was also listening. Anya sensed his struggle. He had experienced so much horror. He had heard her story. He simply didn't know what to believe.
Treasure hunters sought out the jar and released the demons back into the world because of greed. Wasn't that evil? But obviously they did it when the demons were trapped in the jar, right? And after you've trapped all the demons and you find out evil hasn't left the world, what then, Aiden? When you start to feel frustrated in your very praiseworthy desire to do ultimate good, and the demons start to whisper from their captivity that they can give you the power to do the good you so want to do, what will you do then?
I don't know. But I hear them now, whispering to me. They're telling me not to listen to you, Anya. We know what their advice is worth now, don't we, Anya, love? What about you? Do you want it then?
No.
She hoped she wasn't answering too quickly, perhaps making him think she was trying to cover uncertainty with emphasis. She wasn't. She had no interest in the relic, other than to keep it from causing more harm.
It isn't for me, Aiden.
He glanced around as if at a flock of gnats buzzing about his head.
Should I destroy it, then?
He held it out over the crucible. Orange light glowed on its rounded belly. The Russians raised their guns again.
Do you really want to destroy such an artifact, such a part of history?
Your principal will hire professional archaeologists to see to the jar's preservation.
He has already done so, Mr. Pascoe.
And if we give you the jar, what then? What becomes of us?
We walk out of here. You get on with your young lives.
Do you trust him, Anya?
They could have shot me. I don't see we have any choice but to trust them.
After an endless moment's consideration, Aiden's shoulders slouched. He seemed to shrink along with his ambition. He tossed the jar to Karolin. The Russian fielded it deftly. He gestured briskly. A man with his AKS hanging from a waist-length sling by his side brought a bulky satchel. When he opened it, Anya noticed the sides were unusually thick, as if insulated. A man even shorter and skinnier than Karolin, whom Anya had not noticed previously, in a rumpled brown suit, came forward and frowned at it through thick-rimmed and thick-lensed glasses. He nodded abruptly. At a nod from Karolin, the priest with the most grandly decorated hat and the grandest beard came up and blessed jar, satchel, or both with sweeping gestures. Then Karolin carefully placed the jar in the satchel, closed it up, and handed it to the bear-like man.
Miss Green, my patron, Mr. Garen Braden, thanks you.
Anya's blood ran cold. He nodded and smiled.
Good day, Miss Green, Mr. Pascoe.
He walked with his bantam rooster walk out the side door into the sunlight. His men followed without a backward glance. Anya and Aiden sat at the base of the giant statue of Christ the Redeemer that gazed down upon Rio de Janeiro with arms outstretched. They watched tourists appear at the far end of the walk that led across the flattened hilltop to the statue, hot and sweaty from trudging up the 222 steps embossed in the side of the thumb-shaped granite dome called Corcovado Mountain from the road. Behind them, the sun was sinking.
You know, if there is a god, he must have a mighty sense of humor. He made us, after all.
Are you still a doubter, after what you've experienced?
Just because I've seen some unbelievable things doesn't necessarily imply the existence of an all-powerful creator. Nor does the existence of a living embodiment of good, actually.
Good point. And thanks so much for being so helpful with my own crisis of faith.
He looked at her, alarmed, until she smiled enough to let him off the hook.
Did we do the right thing, do you think?
I think that's the sort of thing that has to get left to the verdict of history. What do you think?
I think we did. Hope we did.
I suspect that's about as much confirmation as we're ever going to get. For anything, really.
I'm afraid you're right. And I thought I could solve all the world's problems by trapping some surly spirits inside a tin pot. You must think me a right git.
Anya took him by the chin, turned his face to hers, and kissed him.
I think you're a wonderful man, Aiden.
They looked in different directions, suddenly self-conscious.
So, what's next?
What do you mean?
Us.
What does your heart tell you?
His brows lowered over his eyes, which were lighter than the tropical late afternoon sky.
Do you answer every question with a question?
Do you?
All right, then. Do you have to answer my bloody question either like Dr. Phil or a fortune cookie?
I guess it goes with the job. Or maybe I'm just rationalizing a secret desire to pontificate.
Hard to think of you as pontificating. Although if the church were ever to get its hooks in you, I think you'd make a smashing first female pope.
Don't go there. There supposedly was a female pope, and she was called Joan. Controversial women of the Catholic Church by that name are something of a sore subject for me.
I can see why.
For a moment, he gazed off at Sugarloaf Peak, jutting up out of the bay.
In my hands, just for a moment, I held...
Damnation.
I suppose you're right. Thank you for helping me make the right choice. Especially counterintuitive as it was.
Don't thank me. The choice was all yours. Otherwise it wouldn't have counted.
It hurts a bit, becoming home doubly empty-handed. I don't get the girl and I don't get the relic. Whatever am I going to tell my uncle?
He was expecting you to come home with a girl.
You know what I mean.
But you're not going back to him with nothing to show. Not unless he's so old-fashioned he doesn't watch television.
Whatever do you mean?
I've gotten in touch with some friends of mine who work for the Discovery Channel. They'll be getting in touch to interview you. I believe they intend to devote a large part of a one-hour feature to you. And your uncle, of course, as your patron.
To me? Because I found a jar I don't bloody have anymore. What am I supposed to tell them, that I handed it over to the Russian mafia? Good God, woman. You'll be the ruin of me.
No, silly. They want to make you into an archaeologist superstar for your part in busting a major international relic forgery ring that branched into multinational murder. Even if the old gent isn't satisfied with your results, you'll still have your reputation made.
Whatever am I supposed to tell them?
Not the truth, certainly.
They laughed, perhaps louder and longer than was strictly necessary. Some Japanese tourists passing by glanced at them, then quickly away. It was impolite to stare at crazy people.
What about you? Did you get what you were looking for?
Yes. I saw a very powerful relic into safe hands.
I pity the zealot who tries to pry the jar out of the fortified dacha of a former KGB mucky-muck. I do believe I'd pay to see them try.
She smiled. It was in part to cover her real thoughts. She had fulfilled her true role when she made the choice to turn away from the temptation of near-ultimate power the jar may have offered. She knew Garin Braden was worried about what power he might derive from the relic. She'd worry about that another time. She felt certain Garin did not present an immediate threat. By mutual accord, they stood. He held out his hands.
It's goodbye, I suppose, and not au revoir.
It's better that way. We both know it is. What we came together to do, we've done.
And a right lot of fun it was, too.
She smiled and kissed him.
Yes, a lot of fun.
She blinked her eyes rapidly to clear them of sudden moisture.
Right then. Goodbye, Anya, love. And thanks for everything.
Goodbye, Aiden.
He turned and walked jauntily down the steps toward the vast and teeming city, leaving Anya standing alone in the shadow of Christ the Redeemer, with his arms outstretched to the world. She turned to face the statue.
Well, boss, where to next?
Rogue Angel, Solomon's Jar is a graphic audio production. Rogue Angel trademark owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2006, Worldwide Library. Production copyright 2007, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Narrated by Nanette Savard, with performances by Colleen Delaney, Terrence Aselford, Richard Rowan, Jeff Baker, David Coyne, Ken Jackson, James Konacek, Bruce Allen Rauscher, and Mort Shelby. Directed by Nanette Savard. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornette. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Nathaniel Perry and Temeskin Wubna. The Rogue Angel theme was composed by Chris Rowan. Additional original music by Dan Smith and Nathaniel Perry. Book adapted for graphic audio by Casey Jones. If you enjoyed Rogue Angel, be sure to look for Simon R. Green's Deathstalker series, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Rogue Angel Number 1, Destiny.
Anya reached out her right hand, reached out into that otherware, and summoned the sword. She held it in her hand. Garin's eyes widened as he got to his feet and came toward her.
Let me see it.
No.
Anya leveled the sword, aiming the point at his Adam's apple, intending to halt him in his tracks. In a move that caught her totally by surprise, Garin tried to grab the blade in his left hand and slam his right forearm down to break it. Instead, his hand and arm swept through the sword as if it weren't there. Anya reacted at once, throwing out a foot that caught Garin in the side and knocked him away. He scrambled to his feet and fisted the bread knife on the counter. As Garin brought the bread knife around, Anya took a two-handed grip on the sword and slashed at the smaller blade, wondering if it would pass harmlessly through. Garin was left with just the handle in his fist. Anya planted the sword tip against his chest, right over his heart. Maybe Garin couldn't touch the sword, they both realized, but the sword could touch him.
Are we done here?
Garin swept his left arm against the blade to knock it away, but again his arm passed through. His effort left him facing Anya, his chest totally exposed to her retaliation. Anya pressed the sword against his chest.
I've fed you breakfast. I've overlooked the fact that you broke into my house. I'm even willing to forgive you for trying to break my sword.
Your sword?
Mine.
The sword was hers. It had chosen her. That much was clear.
But if you ever make an enemy of me, if you ever try to kill me like you did Rue, I'll hunt you down and return the favor.
If I try, you'll never see me coming.
Then it would be in my best interests to kill you now, wouldn't it?
Garin stood stubbornly against the sword. Anya pressed harder, watching the pain flicker through his features and hate darken his eyes. He stumbled back, then turned and walked away. She let him retreat without pursuit. Garin wiped at the blood seeping through his shirt.
How much?
For what?
Almost casually, as if she'd been doing it forever, Anya balanced the sword over her right shoulder.
To break the sword.
I'm not going to break this sword.
In truth, she didn't know what would happen if she tried. An image of the lightning bolt passing through it filled her mind. She had a feeling that whatever happened if she tried to destroy the sword wouldn't be good. Also, she felt that she would be betraying the spirit of the weapon.
I could give you millions. You wouldn't have to live like this.
I happen to like the way I live.
You love knowledge. With the money I could give you, would give you, you could go anywhere in the world. Study anything you like. With the best experts money can buy, you could open up any door to the past you wanted to.
The idea was tempting. She believed Garin could provide that kind of money. She even believed he would.
No.
As if to take the temptation out of his hands, she willed the sword away. He came at her without warning, rushing at her low and grabbing her hips as he shoved her back against the stove. He fumbled for one of the knives in the wooden block by the sink. Grabbing a thick-bladed butcher's knife, he raised it to strike. Freeing her right arm from Garin's grasp, Anya drove the heel of her palm into his nose. Blood spurted as the cartilage collapsed. He tried to hang on to her. His knife hand came down. Anya twisted and avoided the knife. The blade thudded deep into the countertop. She reared up against him, forcing him back. Shifting, she butted him aside with her hip, stepped on his foot, head-butted him under the chin, and brought an elbow strike into line with his jaw. Garin stepped back, his black eyes glassy. He punched at her, but she slapped his arm aside. Then he caught her with an incredibly fast left hand. Anya dropped as if she'd been hit with a bag of wet cement. Her senses spun, and for a moment she thought she was going to pass out. Garin came after her immediately. On the ground, she knew from experience, his greater size and weight would take away every advantage her speed and strength gave her. She rolled backward and flipped to her feet in the center of the loft. Anya only had to think of the sword for a split second, and it was in her hand. Stepping back, right leg behind her left, hilt gripped firmly in both hands, she readied the sword. Garin halted, completely out of running room. All Anya had to do was swing, but he'd stopped his aggressions.
Are you going to kill him, then?
Circling slowly, Anya maintained her grip on the sword. She turned just enough to see Rue standing in the doorway. If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.